listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kourula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Host and most, Nikki Kourula. We have a wonderful show and a wonderful guest tonight. Let's welcome saxophonist extraordinaire Leon Silva. Say hello. How are you, dude?
Good, man. It's good to see you.
Likewise. How have you been during the pandemic and all that? I've seen some funny videos of you playing and just like horsing around, but man, it's good to see you just like releasing new music and all that. How did you kind of hang and deal with all of that? Let me ask you that first.
Yeah, that the new music was part of it, man. It's been a long time coming, wanting to do my own thing.
Absolutely.
And so I tried to take that time, that downtime of the pandemic for most of us musicians to really dig into my own artistry.
You know, it's funny because I think I saw you right before everything shut down.
Yeah.
My record and put together this amazing horn section, which you were a part of. And man, it was one of the best and coolest and fun sessions. And then the whole world shut down and it was like, take all that fun and magic away for the moment, you know, for it happening again, you know, during that time period. But I love, you know, and I also felt like every musician I knew was super creative during this time because we had no other choice but to keep working and shedding and writing and making music. I love that you took that you know downtime and made something and you made a record. Tell me what was the inspiration behind it, or was it just the fact that it was immediate and you wanted to, you know, write something in the moment, or were these songs kind of all done over different time periods?
I gotta be honest, it wasn't too much planned out. It was And so just a little correction, I haven't dropped an album yet. I just kind of was just dropping singles here and there as they were coming to me.
Same difference, man.
You know what I'm saying? It's 2021, you know what I mean?
That's right.
But yeah, it just kind of came out of that. I took that time to kind of get over a fear of mine because I'm kind of an introvert anyway. And,
right.
You know, it doesn't really go into.
I feel like everybody's a little bit of both.
You know what I mean?
Makes sense.
Especially when it comes to sharing something so personal to you as art that you create. So,
right.
you kind of afraid of the feedback or you don't think your stuff is good enough as you're putting it out. So I kind of took that chance to just be like, you know what, let me grow some courage and just put it out there. Because, you know, if a million people hate it, maybe one person likes it, and that's cool too.
But wait a minute. You've been touring the world with Justin Timberlake. You've been touring the world with Mighty Mighty Boston's. You've been playing on tracks with Ariana Grande and so many other people. How could you have this fear of, will they like it? You know, everybody likes what you do, man. That's like just how it is. So tell me like where that comes from a little bit.
Yeah, it's I don't know, man. It's just kind of a like I said, man, just had to kind of build up some courage because I've been the side man for 15 years.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So being able to interpret somebody else's music is a talent that I think I do have. And I love doing that. I love working with people, working for people. But when it comes to doing my own thing and being the front, being the headliner of my own thing, it was, it's nerve-wracking to me.
It's terrifying. Honestly, it's terrifying. You know what? Let me tell you something from somebody that has done a lot of records.
Right.
I find that like if you're not challenging yourself and you don't feel that when you're making a record, you're not on the right path. There's actually a sign up here over here. It says if you're on the right path if it's always uphill. So that's how I feel about making records. If there's something about the record that you're not terrified about, then it's not that easy. It just shouldn't be that easy. So it's good. You're on the right path when you're doing something like that. And I love that you drop singles. But let's take it way back before we start playing some of that music. Yeah. What was the moment of Zen that made you want to be a musician? Tell me, was it like the first song you heard? Was it, you know, family inspiration? Was it, you know, friends that you knew that joined band? What was the moment you knew you wanted to play music?
Yeah, I mean, kind of all of the above, but it was, you know, I grew up on the East Coast, just south of Boston in Massachusetts, and
We want all that against you. We want all that against you.
Yeah, we're going to get there, man. you know, but yeah, typical band stuff. So, you know, we started in fourth grade and wow. A friend of mine, yeah, we were, and then they were showing the instruments, the little demonstration. And we said, you know what? Let's play the saxophone and we'll go make money in the subway. You know what
smart.
I mean? We're in fourth grade. Hey, we're trying to hustle. You know what I'm saying?
Started early, man.
Did you start early.
Did you start with alto, tenor? What did you start with? Because fourth grade, that's a big instrument.
It's a big instrument. It's clunky and it doesn't really make too much sense to you, you know. But I started on alto, very typical, you know. But yeah, fast forward into like middle school, I was in the jazz band. Because I was, you know, I played football and, you know, I was kind of all over the place as a kid. Right. But then you came to middle school and I had a great instructor who I'm actually really close friends with now. He's an administrator at Berklee College of Music, my alma mater.
That's awesome.
His name is Scott Trock. So if he ever hears this or is listening, big ups to Scott Trock, much props to him. So he was my middle school and high school band director.
Oh, that's awesome.
And, you know, I just kind of got thrust into the jazz band. Another friend of mine had taught me the F blues scale and it was just like, you know, okay, so I know these notes, you know what I mean?
And were you playing like Charlie Parker stuff?
No, brother, I was barely playing the first five notes of a concert B-flat major scale.
I can't believe it.
You know, and he showed me this F blues scale, and I got into jazz band, and Scott Trock gave me a solo.
Wow.
And in this school, it was a competitive band, you know, IAJE was the thing back then. And so anyway, I had a solo one night and I came to the front of the stage and I closed my eyes. I just elevated like
wow.
Everything disappeared.
You know, chills, man.
You know what I'm saying? Everything disappeared. The stage I was on, I wasn't even on that stage. I wasn't even on planet Earth. And I remember this in middle school. This had to be seventh or eighth grade. And
awesome.
And that feeling, I swear to you, I've always chased that feeling. And sometimes, as you know, this is our profession now. It's our livelihood. So sometimes, you know, it's a job, you know, so to kind of zone out and get to that spot again is, it's always, that's the drug that I chase. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, what's funny. It's, you know, you and I have known each other for a long time. And, you know, what I love about this radio show is that question, because you and I have known each other for so long, but usually we're working on music and we're just like, you know, getting through the sessions and just like hanging and joking around. But you never ask somebody, what was the reason you became a musician? And it's one of the most fascinating questions I can ask all of my musician friends, because it's like there is this electric moment that is larger than life that kind of sets the trajectory of what and why we want to do what we want to do. And you hit it out of the park with that answer, man. You know, it's like, What a great answer. Do you remember when the solo was over?
Oh, it was a Bob Mincer tune called Life of the Party.
Awesome.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that song. Like, it's my favorite song of all time now.
And did you have to, like, were you like third chair, second chair, first? Did you have to like go through the ranks?
You know, I have always maintained I never care what chair I'm in, because I think they are. I mean, since young, we kids, so it was competition, you know, it gotta be lead chair. There's, even in college, it was the same way. You gotta be the lead chair. You know what I mean? Me, I was like, I'll take second chair. I'm cool with that.
Right.
You know, I'm just as important. My voice still gotta be, and I gotta support, you know, you gotta learn balance and blend, which ultimately helped me to do what I do now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Working in sections and doing sessions and stuff like that.
Well, and it's like what's cool is when you play the other parts, usually the first chair you're playing like the most basic tonic or like, you know, the basic part of the melody. But when you get into the second, you actually are playing some of the coolest harmonies.
Ooh, some cool notes, man.
Most buttery notes, exactly.
Yeah.
So I played a little clarinet back in the day. So I know like some of that rivalry with chasing, you know, after chairs and stuff. But really it's like, it's interesting how it all works together. And
absolutely.
How it kind of like all unfolds, and you really find this joy in making music because you're all like working together as a team to make something, and you know, hopefully it sounds beautiful. So you finish your solo, and then you're like, whatever that was, I want to chase this for the rest of my life.
Yeah, man. I think I finished that solo. I went back to my chair and fumbled through the rest of the concert. You know what I'm saying? I was, you know,
riding on that wave, man.
I told you, I knew like five notes other than that that blues scale at that time. You know what I mean? So.
And then you get to high school, and then were you still playing jazz and still kind of being?
Oh man, yeah, and I kind of did the backwards jazz thing where like. A lot of instructors, like you mentioned, Charlie Parker, a lot of instructors will start you there, start you with some big band, classic big band music that's kind of more palatable to an uninformed or uneducated ear. But I kind of started backwards, which like a lot of John Coltrane, a lot of Miles Davis, like Bitches Brew hit me first. And then, you know, this was the 90s and I grew up. Listen, that's Kenny Garrett was the man for every saxophone. You know what I'm saying? So I started there, so like my ear gravitated to more tense harmonies and music and melodies and rhythms, you know. So I kind of stuck out in that sense where a lot of guys were playing more cliche lines and vocabulary that they were kind of reiterating from stuff that they were learning when we were kids. Whereas I was like, I didn't really know that vocabulary, but my ears were leading me in these great, yeah, you know. So it was really cool.
Well, Kenny Garrett and especially John Coltrane, I feel like they're parallels.
Absolutely,
the way they like approach solos and just compositions too. You know, it's just like they're groundbreaking. So for you to be listening to that stuff in high school is already a testament to how great of a musician you are now. Because man, I wasn't listening to that stuff until I was like a music student, influenced by other jazz musicians, like that stuff. So it's amazing, and it makes sense. It totally makes sense. When I have to ask you this, just because you play saxophone, when was the first time you attacked Giant Steps? I have to ask that question.
Man, please, man. I mean, let's see. I've been playing now for like 30-something years, and I'm still attacking Giant Steps, brother. Like, you know, I mean, it's now I'm kind of with it at the point now. And I'm still kind of that type of musician where, like, the cliche lines that can kind of get you through all those 2/5s is you know, it's cool because, you know, they're good. I had a teacher that used to call these things springboards. He was like, use this as a springboard, but then go somewhere else. Let your ears go. Because your ears, and I try to teach that way as well. Your ears you gotta trust your ears a little bit, you know, because they can be your best friend or your worst enemy.
Absolutely.
You know, so even attacking a tune as complicated as Giant Steps, although we can all play 2/5s all day long, I try to find melody. I try to find static notes.
It's like so many changes, but like this really simple melody. So it's like this complex thing.
Which I love, yeah.
Which is why I love it too. And I can't imagine that being the instrument that, okay, I'm going to, when that song is like looming, like over any jazz gig or just sound, or when you're making a record, it's like, you know, he made that and it's just like, I think it's, seriously, one of the greatest of all time compositions that will outlive almost any composer, because it is literally the most simple and the most beautiful and complex combined, you know, composition combined into one. So I have to ask that because it's like you have to have that ambition where you're like when you hear it the first time, you're like, yo, this is my voice. I want to learn this. But that's like a song that you 50 years from now could still be shedding, like what you just said. So
absolutely. And I tell you, I was jaded by songs like that. That song specifically, when I discovered it or when it was shown to me, because it's always taught to you as this is like the holy grail of jazz playing. If you can play this, you can play. You know what I mean? And but I still attack it as it's just another song. There's 12 notes to choose, brother. You got to use your ears and get there. You know what I'm saying? So.
What about Hank Mobley, Soul Station? What about Cannonball? Were those guys like coming into your kind of like psyche as far as what was influencing you or not yet?
1,000%. So I started with that Kenny Garrett world, which everybody in the 90s was on Kenny Garrett, and even the top of the 2000s, you know, and it's still to this day. I mean, Kenny is a defining voice for an alto saxophonist for sure. And I came up as an alto saxophonist. So when I was coming up under him, you know, my tone was like his, my attack was like his, my rhythm. And then I started leaning into Cannonball. Cannonball to me is saxophone in general, that tone, that swing. No, to me, nobody swings like Cannonball.
Well, you have a lot of Cannonball in your tone, man. I swear to God. I
appreciate that, man.
Every time I hear you play, I hear so much Cannonball. So it's funny that he wasn't the first couple names that you mentioned. Yeah. Because when I hear you play, I hear a lot of Cannonball in your playing. I went
through a whole time of like reprogramming myself, my sound. You know what I'm saying? Because even when I first came to L.A., like, I still was kind of in that Kenny Garrett vibe, but, you know, I'm playing a lot of funk and pop, and some of what my interpretation of what Kenny was doing, you know, it was cool.
Right.
But, you know, there was a whole other level to it. So when you start listening to different aspects of all the players and all the vocalists, now you can do something, you know what I mean? And be versatile.
Charlie Parker, Lady Sings the Blues, but Lady Be Good.
Yeah.
That song is seriously one of the best solos, I fell in love with those players, but then you start hearing the Maceo Parkers, you start hearing, you know, all these different Joshua Redmonds, you know, there's so many voices on such a similar instrument. How did you start finding your voice, you know, through high school and college, and you went to Berklee College of Music, one of the best music schools in the country? When was that moment you were like, okay, I want to pursue this and find a deeper, you know, voice or level of composition as far as your artistry?
I think for me, it came from all the times I wanted to quit, you know what I'm saying? Because it was like, you know, the music industry, and specifically musicians, instrumentalists, I will say, is so competitive.
Right.
You know what I mean? And sometimes it's an underlying competitiveness. So, you know, if everyone's sounding like Kenny Garrett right now, it's like, all right, well, I don't want to do that no more because, you know, I didn't find another lane. But, you know, there was something in me also that I always told myself I want to be versatile. So if I was just going to play in that one lane of jazz, then it wasn't conducive to my overall mindset. So then I started taking in the different players, as you mentioned, like Cannonball and Gene Ammons was another big one for me. But then also, one of my favorite saxophones of all time because of his tone and his soulfulness is Kirk Whalum.
The
versatility of that he plays with, you know what I'm saying? So trying to add those things in there. And then, of course, you know, we coming up in the late 90s, the early 2000s. You got D'Angelo coming out. You know what I'm saying? All the stuff Roy Hargrove was doing. You know what I mean? So now you mix in the stuff that I'm learning in the civilian world that I'm listening to, all the funk and the hip-hop and the R&B, and melding it with the complexities of jazz. You know what I'm saying? And it was like, okay, cool. That's where I want to go. So now it's just all about trying to find my own voice. You know what I'm saying? So whatever someone once told me, they said, you know, you always thinking about what to play over the music. And it's like, it's not that hard because the music will always tell you what to do. You just got to listen to the music, man.
So true. And it's so hard. It's like you have to separate the ego from just like the music that's within. And I find that is always the struggle, especially like for me when I solo, it's like I have to quiet the mind. I have to like literally like get back into this feel place. But what I'm so amazed with the players like yourself, you guys get into that mindset right away. Like you're able to just like play and not hear what the mind is saying. Like you maybe just like practice that over and over and over and over since you were a kid, probably soloing in high school and middle school. Tell me what it is that made you silence that voice to just play and not listen to the ego and just play what you feel.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of that within me to this day, you know, when it comes to playing, because there's so many different factors. You got the audience,
right?
But then you've also got the musicians that are around you. You know, musicians are brutal.
So
like,
true. You play a great solo, Miss One Note.
That's what I'm saying. that one note you played over that one chord, you're like, dang,
absolutely. You never live it down.
You know, and then now, like nowadays, I'm playing so much like pop and funk and blues. Yeah. So it's like, you know, like I'm doing a gig with Tito Jackson.
Oh my God, that's amazing,
man! And we should talk about that in a second because those type of experiences in this industry are what, man. Even I sit back sometimes. I'm like, man, this is legendary. And we play, and he's, you know, his stuff is all blues, man.
That's awesome. He's a great guitarist, man.
He's amazing. He's so soulful. Oh, man, he's dirty soulful, man. Yeah. And so, you know, that band is led by another friend of ours, Brandon Brown, out here in L.A., one of the best bass players on the planet. And I remember there was one tune, the saxophone kind of plays off throughout the song, just riffing off of what Tito's singing. And he was like, yeah, give me kind of like that Saturday Night Live saxophone. I'm like, bet. But you know, those are those times where it's like, okay, let me miss some of those altissimo notes. And you know, the whole band looking at you like,
you're gonna do that?
Like, you didn't quite make that one, homie. But you know,
before we get to all these amazing people that you played with, I gotta ask you, when you auditioned for Berklee, what did you audition with?
Oh man, shoot, what was it? Man, it was dating myself, it was so long ago. It was some blues. I think I just had to play blues and some standard. And I couldn't tell you what I played at this point. It was probably some blues and
okay.
I have no idea what I played at that point.
So I'll tell you that
You know, because I'm from Massachusetts, I was so connected with that school and those educators that I think there was definitely some part of a doorway in there. So they had known me for like 4 or 5 years before I even was going to college, right, which was super helpful.
So you get to Berklee, and when you just like, you know that day one of music school, you're like kind of sizing. It's like Top Gun. I mean, you're like, all right, we're here. Yeah. Who's the best, and how are we going to work together? Or who's the one you don't want to avoid? Or how did you find like your groove and your sound and your voice going through that environment? Because I know even just going through USC's program, that was like one of the hardest things to do is just like get through the program and then also find exactly what you wanted to do in music and kind of like create your own voice. Tell me what that was like for you.
For me, it wasn't that difficult in the beginning because, like I said, I'm from there. So I was always around. So even before I was of age, I was milling around the school, you know what I mean, and just kind of latching on to people. And there was a couple of musicians in particular, Jaleel Shaw, one of the most phenomenal saxophonists and musicians, period, that I've ever met. And he kind of, I remember the first time I heard him, just a switch went off. And I was like, oh, that's what you do. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so up the street from Berklee in Boston on Mass Ave, there's a little club called Wally's Jazz Cafe, which is, I mean, if you're ever in Boston, you're a musician, you need to stop there. It used to be Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays were really good nights to be there. I'm not sure what it is now, but it's a little hole-in-the-wall jazz club. But, man, it's soulful. I mean, everybody goes through there. Wenton used to go down there. Kenny would go down there. You know, you just random nights, you know. And so we used to sneak in there. I mean, 14 years old, I'm sneaking in there, you know, fumbling around with my blues scale. And I got called out for that a couple times, too, you know. But, yeah, just being in the midst of that and having those sounds come at you all the time, you kind of almost can't help but to chase that. I mean, if you want to, you know what I mean? If you got the will to do it. So that helped me out a lot.
So you graduate, and then when did you come to L.A., and when did you link up with Sean, Eric, and Kevin Williams for the regiment?
Yeah, shout out the Regiment Horns. That's my crew. Me and Kevin, Kevin is our trombonist. He's actually a trombone, flute, tuba. Me and Kev go back to middle school.
Oh, wow.
He's from the same area as me. So we go back to middle school, went to college together, lived in college together, and then he moved to LA before I did. And then I came afterwards. And same with Sean. I met Sean at Berklee. He's a year or two younger than I was, but we played in a lot of the same bands. So Sean, Kevin, and I played in a bunch of different bands together in different combinations of the three of us, but never together. But we all knew each other. So then we came out to L.A., got the Regiment Horns together. We had a tour that was asked of us to go on. But as soon as we got to L.A., I mean, the day we landed, they were like, yep, sorry, tour is canceled.
Oh, welcome to the music business right there.
Bro, yeah, and it was like, I ain't got no money to get back. It was just stuck, you know what I mean? It was rough, but we stuck it out, so. Yeah, that's
how I got to LA. They stuck it out, but not only are you guys one of the most sought after horn sections, but now you've been playing with Justin Timberlake. You've done maybe two or three tours. No, maybe four or five tours now. How many tours?
Who was it? I think in total it's probably three.
Man,
Big Three.
You know what? It's seriously, that whole band, it's one of the best bands I've ever
seen. Life-changing.
Man, I saw you guys play at the Rose Bowl with Jay-Z. I saw you do your own tour with the 2020 tour. And then I saw the Woods. It was Into the Woods? No, it was called
Man of the Woods.
Man of the Woods, that's right. Man of the Woods tour. I mean, all those tours, the band is so slamming. Tell me what it was like, just kind of like playing with your bros in a group like that, night after night after night. Tell me what that like feeling or musicianship, what was that experience like for you?
After the journey of having been canceled the first time we got to LA to ending up there, I mean, we were always at the clubs. We hit the clubs all the time, you know what I mean, as a crew. You know how the business is. If we weren't getting paid, nada. We took a lot of hits, paid a lot of dues, and that's how we got discovered by some people in Justin's camp. And so we started recording for some of Justin's artists and then ultimately recorded for Justin, and then Justin said, come on the road. So it was amazing. And then so we were hired by Justin Timberlake, personally, which
that's
is awesome. Like,
that's incredible. Not many people could say that.
Man, so then in the process, we meet this other superstar, Adam Blackstone, who is just on top of his game. And he to this day amazes me. Like, he's like a human hard drive. Like, because
it's amazing how many MD gigs he's with. Eminem, he's with Timberlake. He's with Ariana Grande for a little bit. He's just
he's with Ed Sheeran now. Yep. I mean, Nicki Minaj. I mean, he's all over the place. And for those of you who've never seen him or heard him, you've probably seen him or heard him every award show you ever see. You know, BET, Grammys, American Music Awards. He's the MD now. You know what I mean? So, working with him, just that was another, you know, I got a chance to work with a lot of producers in LA. And then working with a person like Adam and his attention to detail, the things that he hears, because, you know, part not of working with an artist like Justin, you got to play some his hits. He's got such a catalog. So, you know, Adam was just so good at hearing everything that was going on in those tracks and then being able to reproduce them on stage.
Wow.
And, you know, it's a live show, but there are tracks running, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, can't play everything that are in those tracks. You know, Timbaland is a beast. You know what I mean? But Adam's attention to detail in the music, but also still keeping it funky and soulful. His attention to how to operate and how to deal with musicians, how to deal with the artists, how to deal with the business. Oh, it was just next level.
Well, there's also like these interludes and postludes that you guys are doing in between songs, and I know he's got a heavy hand in kind of like arranging some of those and working with you guys to do it. But it's like, yeah, you're right. What I felt was like, you know, with all the 2020 stuff and the Man of the Woods, you guys brought a lot of those records to life live. Like, it was man, it was off the chain. I mean, the arrangements were great. The performances were great. It was just amazing to see you guys up there in all these different capacities and tours. And, man, I got to say, you know, like, when you see your boys, like, up there doing that, I mean, you're proud. I mean, it's like, because I also know, you know, we've been playing together a long time, and I know the road you guys took, and I know, like, how long you guys have been cutting your teeth. And so to see you guys there, it's like, I have to be there to watch that because it's like, I know where you guys came from and all the work you put in and all the sessions and gigs you guys have done that weren't like that, you know? So when you see it like that, it's amazing. Tell me, like, you know, when you're touring with Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, it's a different gig. It's a different bag. How do you switch hats and how does that kind of like, you know, help you balance as a musician?
First of all, big shout out to the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones. This was an ironic thing that I played with them because I'm from Massachusetts.
Right.
Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, obviously a Boston band, Boston ska band, one of the most famous ska bands of the 90s. And it was this working with them was one of those moments for me that made me realize that all the stuff that had been going on through the years. Working with the Boss Tones and working in that idiom of music was all of it came together because ska is such a hodgepodge of so many different styles of music.
Right.
I mean, there's reggae, there's funk, there's soul. You can pick so much stuff out of it. And so, you know, again, like I said before, I've always tried to be a versatile musician. Like, I want to be able to be a chameleon and play in any style of music. Well, this is kind of all that just says it's musical guacamole. You know what I'm saying? Right. And to be honest, some of that music was those gigs are harder than playing the big pop gigs with an artist like Justin. You know, only because Justin, you know, it's in general. I mean, there's some nuances that change every night, but most nights it's the same show every night. Right. It's a well-rehearsed show. It's a production, lights, cameras, blah, 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 dancers, everything. Ska band, this band in particular, it's the band in the audience. You know what I'm saying? And the set changes every night. I don't care if we playing 5 nights a week, 6 nights a week, the set's changing every night. And they got so many songs. And it's a rock band, so, you know, more, they're mostly all in E. So, you know, so for me, I ain't know all the songs.
All my songs aren't in E, just so you know, right?
They, you know, on the last album we just did, it's called When God Was Great. We just put it out last year, recorded it during the pandemic, and it was such a great album. I got to write and arrange all of the most of the horn parts, not all of them. There's other input into there. But, yeah, working with that band is just – I love working with the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, man. You know, and, you know, I'm no spring chicken out here in L.A. Right. But for that band, I'm the baby in the band, you know.
But you know what? You bring a lot of fire, too. So it's like that's why they're giving you those duties of arranging all those things. And, man, I've seen so many cool clips that you posted of you playing these crazy, fiery solos and getting the crowd, like, you know, razzled. And it's just – it's awesome, man. It's awesome.
And that's one thing with them, because for years, you know, I've been with them now, I think 5 or 6 years. And in the beginning stages, you know, I'm learning all this music. So I'm learning the saxophonist that was there previous to me. I'm learning all his parts. I'm learning all his solos. Because I'm in my mind, I'm like, that's what the audience wants to hear. They want to hear that. Because some of it, you know, some of it's just very melodic, and it's a part rather than a solo, which is another, you know, thing to, you know, think about when you're doing this stuff. So, it was like one random night in like Germany or something. I was like, you know what? I'm gonna just do me tonight. And
you're like, we're in Germany, but they're not gonna care.
Yeah, which is crazy. You know what I mean? So the Dickie Barrett, who's the lead singer of the band, I just went off on a solo, just kind of just took a left turn, and he looked back. He was like, F, yeah, that's what we was waiting for. You know, it ain't what he said.
Swear on this like show,
oh, shit, yeah. I think my mom's just watching. Sorry, man.
My mom, too. I swear.
Give me that energy to do that. You know what I'm saying? But, you know, I do try to still walk a line that's still palatable to their audience, and it still fits the style of music. You know what I mean? But, right. But yeah, some nights I'm just like, you know what, let's do this instead of that, you know?
Well, you know, it's funny because I remember when I started the songwriting team, The Element, and we all had lunch. And the best part of the, you know, the whole thing, my writing partner, Dimitri, was like, yeah, man, you know, if you guys ever have any parts, you know, kind of like, you know, that sax part on Problem with Ariana Grande, you like interrupted, you raise your hand, you're like, that's me, actually. And he was like, what? And I was like, I told you, these guys are the best, man. These guys are the best. What was it like? You know, you come in, like, you know, from a jazz perspective and playing with these heavy hitters. Now you're in this, like, pop starlet thing, and you're playing, you know, something. You know, you're probably sent that in, right? And you hear that song everywhere. And that song blew up. But what is driving that? Is that sax line, that hook.
Right, right.
You have to have a moment where you're like, man, I played that. You know, there has to be a moment, or was it just, or is it just like, yeah, man, it was only 5 notes or 4 notes, whatever it was. Like,
oh, no, man. You know, I'll never say that, man. You can let me play one note. I'm cool. Let's go. If it's going to make the record hot, then let's go.
Right,
you know
what I mean? No, but that had to be a great feeling.
That record happened, you know, I'm bouncing back between emails with Max Martin and Ela Pavaz, I think his last name was, and you know, and at the time, you know, I was living with my mother-in-law. Wow. So I recorded this in my now wife's bedroom.
Wow.
You know, on a USB mic, you know what I'm saying? Because I had no money, you know what I mean? But I was like, I am for damn sure going to record this. You know what I'm saying? And so, you know, they sent me the mock-up. I mean, the track sound completely different back then, you know what I'm saying? But he sent me the mock-up, and he was like, so we need you to do this, but we need you to do it, like make it something else. So, I mean, I forget what the melody originally was, and I sent him 3 takes back, and all pretty much the same, you know, and I was just like, okay, so I was like, I need to make it different. And I remember saying to myself, because I was just like kind of humming around on it, and I'm like, nah, I got to make it different. So I just started just growling through the horn, and I just played the most simple thing I come up with, but it was just like, it was poppy, and it was in there.
It's dirty, it's grooving, it's gritty, it's awesome.
I promise you, any records that I've ever made money on was when I'm able to go there. You know what I'm saying?
And you let go. You let go.
And
you
But that dirty, funky sax, I love that. I love that world. I love playing funk, which to me is how I approached it, because it's a pop record, but I was like, I need to put like some Junior Walker, some old, like, just funky, dirty saxophone on here. And he took it and he added a couple effects to it, and you know.
Let's be honest. You had a heavy hand in what that sound is.
I did
a couple little effects, but dude, what it is you playing gritty, you coming up with that figure, and it's driving. It drives the whole track. And what's amazing is, like, you know, what I find is so fascinating. I find that, you know, a lot of musicians, they do one thing that's really great. But with you, and this is why I was like always on you about like, hey man, we got to do this interview, because you have this like ability to just lay out so much stuff in different genres. You play with Neo, you're playing with Tito Jackson, Justin Timberlake, Mighty Mighty Boston's. These are like not all the same genre at all.
Right.
You know what
I
mean? So it's like, it's not just like, oh yeah, I'm just playing, you know, musical chops or whatever. There's a specific bag that you have to kind of know, and you know them all. You know them all. I mean, that's a testament to your musicianship. Now, when it comes time to you making your own record, how does that kind of like maybe alter or drive what you're throwing down and how you're like, are you letting yourself go on that same tangent? Like, I'm just going to like let it all out. Or are you kind of like having some restraint or battling both of those?
I think it's a good mix of the battle, you know? So I'm getting to the point where I'm just letting go and just whatever comes out. Cause I mean, I have some more songs coming out in the near future that, I mean, they're, some of them are on, out of left field. I mean, this year, I mean, the pandemic kind of messed us all up. I mean, I don't know about you, but I had a couple moments during the pandemic. I mean, I had some existential crisis moments, you know what I'm saying? And so so some of the songs are kind of, like, if you hear one song, I mean, you can still hear it's my voice, but I mean, the music, I mean, once, you know, like, one of my songs right now, my last single is kind of just funk, pop-driven kind of thing, dance kind of music. Some of this other stuff, it's like, okay, he's doing drugs. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I mean, it's easy to go to dark places when you're in that mindset too, man. You know?
Yeah, man. And so, but still today, I'm just like, you know, I love that. I don't, and you know, that's why I think I resonate with that Scott, with the Mind My Boss Tones and Scott so much, because it's never just one thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So.
Well, I hope you always continue to make music. Let's hear something. What do you want to play us first?
Well, my most recent single is Smoke, that came out October 1st, and it's it's people listen to it a little bit. It's we can jump into there.
Yeah, let's hear it. Let's hear it. This is Smoke by Leon Silva. Hot damn, dude. That is so good.
Appreciate you, man.
Stinky face. I was just like, dude, slamming.
Appreciate you, man. Appreciate
I love that
you.
Part of the solo where you're like, you're laying so back, man. It's like, you just like, you did like these cool licks and then you just started laying back this lick. Man, just such tasteful playing, great composition. Tell me, like, what was the inspiration behind that song?
Oh, man, I don't even know, man. That's one of them deals. It was funny because I debuted this song at Vibrato Jazz Grill. and they were like, smoke. Oh, man, he talking about smoking weed. Or, you laid back, dude. Funny thing about it, I was at my boy, at Kevin's house, trombonist for the regiment. And yep. He's a phenomenal chef. A phenomenal.
Oh, I didn't know that. Seriously? Man,
oh, he throws dude.
Dude, love that.
And it was over the summer and he was grilling. And he was smoking all this meat. Like, I mean, like big briskets and everything.
Right.
And so I was like, you know,
I knew they loved barbecue. Like,
you know what I mean?
With smoking. Yeah.
And so I got a little smoker outside in the backyard. Nothing like he got. So I was out there making a roast. And I came in that night and I was just chilling. I just started writing. And I was like, oh yeah, this is called smoke.
That's amazing. I love that. That's amazing. It's slamming, dude. The groove is awesome. I love the horn parts. I love the solo. It's just everything. I mean, you're kind of soloing throughout, but it's amazing. It's a great track.
Appreciate you.
Now, when you're like, you know, now that you know what it's like to do your own record and you're your own maverick, when did you kind of know that the song was done, like mix-wise, everything? Was it kind of like, were you kind of like just going through the motions of like, oh my God, I'm on mix number 99 and it's still not right? Or were you able to kind of like distance yourself from it a little bit?
Literally mix 99, you know what I'm saying? I'm still not happy with it, bro. You know what I'm saying? Like, and I read going through the paces that you understand, you overstand this process. So, man, I read somewhere Michael Jackson was still, you know, up until he passed, still wasn't happy with the mix on Thriller.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, what? So to give people perspective of like, at some point, you do have to just give it away. You know, my wife was a big supporter. My wife is also a musician. Shout out to Bridget Sarai, who's got a lot of music out there as well. She's a vocalist. She sings Kelly Clarkson. She's now singing for Mariah Carey. Yeah, she's doing her thing. And she was kind of one that's just like, the mix is fine. I was like, yeah, you live with me. You tired of hearing it over and over again.
You know what my girlfriend says? She's like, why do you guys have to listen to it over and over and over again? I'm like, we're listening to different mixes. And she's like, man, they all sound the same. I'm like, but they don't sound the same.
Like, you don't hear that hi-hat. Yeah,
exactly.
This one.
You know what? It's like the best advice I ever got. You know, I work with, you know, you've met Doug when we did the record. So he's the one that kind of told me, he was like, will not affect sales. That is something you have to remember. Like when you're like in the mix and you're in the trenches and you're on mix number 99 and you're about to do mix number 100, there has to be a point where you're like, is this change going to affect the sales?
Mm-hmm.
You would have had it probably at 57 or 63. And the other
probably
thing.
Probably had it at 2.
Right. The other thing he taught me was like, you know, when you're in the studio and you're making a song, your job is just to get it to 98% because there's no such thing as 100%.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as 100% perfect. And there's maybe 1,000 different ways to get it to 98%. So once you get it to 98%, that's when you know, okay, I can release this.
It's, let it go.
But I mean, those two things kind of gave me this like peace of mind. It's like, okay, I don't have to be neurotic about it because I'm just going to find another way to get it to a different kind of 98%. It's not going to necessarily get better. So those two little pieces of wisdom, that's on the house, Leon. That's on the house.
Listen, I'm writing it down right now, man. You know how hard it is to stick to that wisdom. But I'm
Well, I mean, it's funny. It's like I was talking to, I think, Bernie Grumman about this. He was talking about the Bodyguard soundtrack. They came in with 63 mixes of I Will Always Love You. You know what mix they ended up choosing for the master?
The very first one.
No, it was
the rough.
Number 3.
Oh, was it 3? Okay. Wow.
Which is crazy. It's like they did 63 mixes of that song.
Man.
that they didn't really need to do. But, you know, it's like they ended up going with number three because of whatever variance that made it what it was. So it just gives you some perspective that you start to lose that perspective once you're on mix 9, 10, 11, 12.
Oh, that perspective is gone at that point. And, you know, it's what's, you know, I'm to be honest, I'm still like a super novice producer.
It doesn't sound like it though.
I appreciate it. For me, the process right now is finding what music that I like, you know, sonically,
right,
you know, and trying to get it there on multiple speakers, off the cell phone, off the laptop, on my monitors, in cars, you know the drill. So you know.
Yep. And the other thing too, it's like somebody once told me, you know, when you're making music, make music you want to hear. And I was like, oh, well, it's such a simple thing to say, but right. When you think about it, it's like, really, that is it. It's like, make music you want to listen to, because if you don't want to listen to it, who else is going to want to listen to it? You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So, I love it. Dude, let's play something else. What are you playing us for the second one?
All right, so the second one would, I guess that's, it'd be my, actually my second release called Till the Wheels Fall Off.
Yeah. I like the title already. Here's Till the Wheels Fall Off by Leon Silva. I could have kept going, man. I keep like stopping dancing. I'm just like, man, it's moving. Dude, what a slamming groove. What a slamming melody. I love the grit in your playing. Man, you always throw down whenever you're recording. How did you figure out what take of what solo to put on there? Because I know you're a musician. You're going to be like, all right, I'm going to do a couple takes. Or yeah. Was that the take you were like, yo, that's the one? Or did you kind of like figure out there were a couple that you wanted to kind of comp? Or how did you kind of go about the soloing?
That one I think was pretty much straight down. The last song, Smoke, was straight down, but it was, it was definitely a few takes in. But, you know, I try to do as a practice now because another good friend of mine had posted something. His name is James Casey, a phenomenal saxophonist out in New York. And he had tweeted something one day. He was like, man, we cutting all these records because of the pandemic. So you got the – you know, I have all the power in my hands. It doesn't matter if I can't blow an 8-bar, 12-bar, 16-bar solo all the way through. I'm just comp it all up, make it work, you know? So it was like, it just made me think, I was like, okay, I have to play a solo from top to bottom while in the studio at the house, you know what I'm saying? So some of those were from top to bottom.
Well, what's cool is like, you know, I always, whenever I track a solo, I always need 3 takes of complete bullshit where it's like, all right, let me get all the noodling, like the crazy licks out of me that I'm never going to put on a record. Let me get those out in the first 3 takes, and then I'll be like, all right, now let's really record. And I need to actually record them so it's like something in my mind goes, yo, these are bullshit takes.
Yeah.
Get them out while you can, because then you get serious about it. But you know what? With your kind of playing, I know you don't have those takes. So,
man, how do please.
You get into that? No, man. You're a great player. You're very tasteful, man.
Thank you.
Like, when you're approaching this, do you kind of just close your eyes and get back to that first moment when you were playing in middle school? Or what's your kind of like creative process when you get to that place?
I think it still goes back to that the music tells you what to do kind of thing. So sometimes I'll sit and start singing. I might play a little bit and then I'll just kind of hum along and sing. And I remember Roy Hargrove used to talk about that a lot. You know, he would actually sing his entire solos, or at least segments of it, and then transcribe his singing, you know, because I mean, that's the most natural instrument in the world is your voice and what's coming from you that way. So sometimes I'll just do that. But now, to be honest, because I'm producing all this music of my own, I mean, from scratch to the end, that, you know, I look at it as a movie anyway, so you kind of see the ending as you starting anyway. So, you know, even within a solo, I'm like, I know where I want to go. You know what I mean? So
hear it. I mean, it's like, it's thematic. It's like, it sets an atmosphere and a mood. It's got grit. It's got emotion. It's got all the colors you want in a composition, a solo, and just a groove. Man, you hit all the marks, man. So I hope you never stop making songs like this and records like this, and you just keep doing it, man, because like you got something. And every time you've been playing a track, I'm sitting just like grooving in my chair, and then the music stops and I'm like, oh man, it's like hypnotic. So please never stop making music. We're going to play one more, but real quick before we do that, how can people find you if they want to ask you to play on a record, or if they want to have you go on tour? Where can people find you online, or where can people find you?
Before I do that, I just want to say shout out to my mother, Trish, and my father, Leon Sr., who's listening and did text me about those swear words that I used. She just texted me that. I did listen.
That's awesome.
You can find me on any of my social medias. Facebook, just look up my name, Leon Silva, S-I-L-V-A. And then Twitter or Instagram is Leon_Silva_onsax.
Awesome. Leon, you're an incredibly talented musician. I feel so honored to get to play with you, to do records with you. And I'm doing an electric blues trio. I'm having you play on that record too. So don't worry, I'm going to have you play. And we're going to do a bunch of James Brown kind of arrangements. So we're going to go crazy with horns on this next thing. But before we do that, I just want to say thanks for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. You're welcome anytime to be a guest, because I just want to showcase artists like yourself. You're a great friend. You're a great musical mind yourself and an incredible artist and player. And thank you for being a guest, man. What are we ending the show with? What are we playing?
Thank you for having me, Nikhil. It was a long time coming. I'm glad we got to do it. Thank you so much, my brother. This last song was actually my first single out. This is called Dusk to Dawn.
All right. From Dusk to Dawn, here's Leon Silver. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Leon, once again, you're a tremendous artist, man. Keep shining bright. Stay healthy. Stay, you know, true to who you are, because you are just a beacon of light, man. We love you, and thank you again for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood. Keep making music. I'll see you on the flip side. We're going to make some more music together, all right?
All love, brother. Thank you so much.
On behalf of Sam, myself, thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll see you here next week. Peace and love. Woo!
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.